Thanks for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. Patience and persistence emerged as two themes of President Obama's primetime press conference. He reminded Americans his administration has only been in power for 2 months, and that many of the problems facing the nation will take years to fix. He fielded questions on the response to the AIG bonus debacle, passing on problems to the next generation, and whether he would veto a budget that failed to include his top four priorities: tax cuts for the middle class, health care reform, improvements to the nation's energy policy, and investment in education. Joining me to talk about last night's press conference, Eamon Javers with Politico, Byron York of the Washington Examiner, and David Korn with Mother Jones, and a blogger for CQPolitics.com. Do join us. I'll be interested in your reactions to last night's press conference. You are an important part of this program. Call us on 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. You can also reach us through Facebook and Twitter. Good morning, everybody.
Good morning.
Good morning.
How'd you feel about the press conference, David Korn?
Well, I don't think how I feel counts. I think how Barack Obama feels and how people watching out there feels is what counts the most. And he seemed pretty much in command of his own message. And I think that confidence is probably what a lot of Americans are looking for right now. He talked about a lot of the heavy lifting he's doing. And again and again and again, he put forward what I would consider to be a pretty strong progressive message. He said, we're going to continue to invest our way out of the economic trouble we're in. There were lots of questions saying, with the deficits we have and the debt that's amassing, you know, essentially, how can you do health care, education, and energy in addition to repairing the economy? And he just was like a rock. He kept saying this is his economic philosophy, that these structural issues in America have to be fixed in order to continue strong economic growth.
David Korn, a Washington bureau chief of Mother Jones magazine. Eamon Javers, Tom Shales this morning talked about some of the staging issues, that statement that the president read right at the start. Somehow the teleprompter was not working correctly. He was looking straight in the back. Is that right?
Yeah, they had a big box teleprompter in the back as opposed to those two little clear screens that you sometimes see on either side of
so
a president.
So it looked as though he was looking straight ahead as opposed to...
I was sitting right next to it. It was
okay.
Like just gigantic flat screen TV.
Yeah, yeah.
And reporters were saying, well, this is an improvement over the two screens which show when you... But at the same time, I had to say, it's a short statement. I think that anyone that smart should be able to come out and just make his remarks and cover those points without having to read them off the
what
screen.
What did you think?
I don't know
David?
How Tom shares those sorts.
Well, yeah. Well,
couch.
part of the issue there is whether the president is actually looking into the camera, making eye contact. That's psychologically so important for viewers to see that eye contact from their president. If you bungle the eye line of where the teleprompter is physically, then it looks like the president's not looking at the television audience. That can be a little disconcerting and unsettling for viewers. That might be one of their problems last night. But this issue of whether they had to write out this script, you know, we noticed in just before the press conference started last night, and we have an item on this on Politico.com, they released some excerpts of the president's remarks in advance to the press. And then a few minutes later, they released revised excerpts. And so we just compared them word for word and found that they were changing a few words in the remarks, even, you know, an hour or so before the press conference. So clearly, every word of this speech was combed through for exact precision, and they wanted to hit all those words exactly right. That's why he had to use a teleprompter.
Byron York, as an individual as I am, one who listens on radio.
The teleprompter
exactly.
problem.
Like that Nixon-Kennedy debate. You know?
Right. It struck me that his words were straight out, but you watching television may have felt differently.
The staging of it to me was not that important. I mean, the president spoke extemporaneously after his opening statement for, 50 minutes? And handled all the questions. So I just don't see the fact of whether his eyes are not entirely in contact with the camera as a big deal.
Let's go to the first question he was asked by Jennifer Levin of AP. It was about the Fed chair and the Treasury secretary seeking new powers. What's that all about?
Well, the federal government, basically through the FDIC, is able currently to seize control of banks that go under. And this is done, dates back many decades to the Depression, to the Great Depression, and it's to protect investors. And this is a power that the federal government has. What Timothy Geithner, the Treasury Secretary, wants to do is extend that power to all sorts of newer financial institutions like hedge funds or insurance companies like AIG and others. For the federal government to be able to move in, possibly seize assets, take control of them in a way that has traditionally been done only with banks.
And how much does Barack Obama back up that idea?
Well, he appears to back it up 100%. I mean, this is something it was a fairly big issue during the campaign, the idea of regulation, more regulation. Democrats, I think, kind of unfairly blamed Republicans solely for reducing some regulations on banks in the 90s during the Clinton years. But it seems to me that this is the president basically pushing one of his campaign promises.
Heyman Chavers, what did the president mean when he said the culture has led us to this point?
Well, he's really been talking about irresponsibility across the board and this question of whether both government in terms of running huge deficits over the years and business in terms of taking on enormous risks that, as it turns out, we now know they really didn't understand, and individuals running up credit card debt and living beyond their means in terms of their home mortgages. He's talking about all of that as a culture of irresponsibility over the past decade or so, all of which we have to fix. And that, you know, is a sort of a knife to the heart of all of us who have a mortgage that's too big or some credit card debt or who work at a company that's been a little bit fast and loose. The president wants to change a lot about how American society has been working for the past decade or so. And that's a lot to chew on.
He was asked about being slow to anger on the AIG issue, David Korn.
Yeah, that was perhaps one of the more dramatic moments of the night when I guess it was Ed Henry of CNN
right.
who asked him that question. And what I found interesting about the press conference overall is that Barack Obama did not play the populist chord. And I wrote about that at MotherJones.com. I'll follow Eamon's example here. And that, you know, he didn't take the opportunity to come out with a pitchfork. This is a guy who's more comfortable with a pointer than a pitchfork. He likes to explain what went wrong with the economy. He did talk about the excess of corporate greed, and he said he was angry about the bonuses, but he didn't dwell on that anger. That wasn't the lead point here. It was more about explaining what he wants to do with his economic policies. This guy is really focused and very disciplined, and he's not going to be driven off message by an angry mob or Stephen Colbert with a pitchfork. So when Ed Henry asked him, how come it took you days, my God, days to express your anger with these bonuses, he said, I like to think about things before I speak.
And
it was very short to the point.
Absolutely.
And I found it kind of convincing.
Byron.
Well, I also think populist rage, while it may not have diminished in the country, had diminished quite a bit in Washington over the weekend. I mean, there was this growing sense that the House had acted too quickly and imprudently in passing this 90% tax on a lot of bonuses. And the president's own people appearing on the Sunday shows began to back away from it, said there could be constitutional problems and other problems with that. So the president, it seems to me, was not by not doing the populist rage thing, was actually pretty much in line with where thinking in Washington is right now on that.
Eamon Chambers, Chuck Todd of NBC asked about whether the president has truly asked Americans to sacrifice.
Yeah, and the president, his response was interesting. I mean, he said, look, Americans are sacrificing day to day. They're taking all kinds of hits to the pocket and the wallet. And he didn't really suggest that it was his role to sacrifice anymore because of the real economic disaster that Americans are facing right now. And I thought it was interesting. Byron, when he was just giving his answer, referred to the Depression, and then he hesitated and said, the Great Depression, as if we now have to make a decision. Distinction between which depression we're talking about here. I mean, maybe we had the Great Depression and now we're in the not so great depression.
Somebody said we all ought to call it the Great Recession.
Yeah, maybe that's where we're at.
Which I think is a better
way to go. Well, we may be lucky if it's just a recession. Exactly. We may be lucky rather than sort of the great falling apart. You know, about the question that Chuck Todd asked, you know, I was twittering a little bit during the press conference. Didn't expect to be called on, have to keep busy. And, but that question of the night, I have to say, from the people who I follow or follow me on Twitter, got the most reaction, with people thinking that it was, you know, who I heard from, critical of the question. Like, you know, you think, you know, the question seemed to be, well, not recognizing that people are suffering a lot already, so what sacrifice needs to be made from people who are losing their jobs or are facing mortgages they can't pay? It was, you know, I think it was a hard question for Chuck Todd to come back and the follow-up on.
But it really echoes a question that was asked of Barack Obama's predecessor, George Bush, frequently. In the wake of September 11th, did George Bush ask Americans to sacrifice? And the criticism, the knock on Bush, was that he never did. He said, go shopping.
Eamon Javers, correspondent for Politico. And we'll take a short break and be right back. Welcome back to our discussion of President Obama's second primetime press conference in the little more than 60 days he's been in office. Here in the studio, David Korn, Washington Bureau Chief of Mother Jones Magazine, a blogger for CQPolitics.com, Eamon Javers, correspondent for Politico, and Byron York. He's chief political correspondent for the Washington Examiner and author of The Vast Left-Wing Conspiracy. And the phones are open. We'll take your calls, 800-433-8850. Eamon, I know you're wondering how many times the networks are going to go for these primetime conferences.
Right, and the White House knows this, but it's very expensive for the networks to give up an hour of primetime commercial television. They make a lot of money in those hours, and they don't make any if they carry the president for that
but
time.
But let me ask you a question. Suppose NPR took on those primetime news conferences. Don't you think the networks would suffer?
Well, the networks would probably see, well, it's a good question. I don't know the business well enough to know, but I think that a lot of people would still turn out for American Idol, even though NPR was carrying the president.
Well, these press conferences are also on the cable networks, and nearly every television home in America has access to cable, so it's not a way of, it's not a sense of people not being able to see the president if they want to.
It would still be on PBS. And I'd love to see the networks get in the position of trying to make the argument that we're going to show Dancing with the Stars when the president's speaking next door on PBS or the cables. And, you know, it's true that the president last night didn't make news. But, you know, part of the job of a press conference is for reporters to ask, you know, good, hard questions and to see how the, you know, hopefully as representative of what people would want to see asked, and then have the president, see the president in action answering those questions. And it's a lot different than watching him go on Jay Leno go on 60 Minutes, no offense to Steve Kroft. But it's a different setting, and it shows people something about the man.
Byron. Well, the bigger question, I think, is whether whether it's possible for Obama to be overexposed now. He has gone on Jay Leno's 60 Minutes, the full hour press conference, ESPN. I mean, he's been pretty much ubiquitous these days. And this is something I'm sure the White House is going to be watching carefully. And we should remember that this particular press blitz he is doing to push this budget plan.
Let me ask you about this question of overexposure. Overexposure for you guys, for me, for people in Washington, or is it an opportunity for this president to reach out to people across the country who don't necessarily watch Jay Leno, who don't necessarily stay glued?
Most people, you're right, most people do not, you know, absorb all the media that we in this room, and maybe some of your listeners, absorb. So, yes, it's true he did all these things, but not everybody, you know, is watching Jay Leno 60 Minutes and the press conference and watching ESPN and reading newspapers and blogs. So he's done this because he has several economic initiatives he's selling to the public, including a budget with a lot of fundamental change in it. And this seems at least the point now to be making a full-court press, no pun intended. And, you know, and we'll see whether it helps him politically, helps get these bills through Congress, and what happens with his approval ratings and where, you know, and what he has to do next in a couple weeks.
Jake Tapper asked about whether the president would sign a budget that did not include his top priorities, Byron.
And this, I think, was actually the news of the press conference, which is it was a classic Obama performance, smooth, polished, confident. But I think you saw the signs of him beginning to surrender on a couple of things that were previously very important parts of his agenda. The biggest one mentioned by Jake Tapper was the energy cap and trade initiative. And basically, Democratic senators on Capitol Hill have declared this thing dead. And they just don't. It's what is it? $634 billion, I think Obama is proposing to raise through this system, which Republicans call cap and tax. And they're essentially saying it given they've been very rattled by these new Congressional Budget Office estimates of the deficit, you know, showing $9.3 trillion added to the national debt between now and 2019. And they've declared this dead. So I think what you saw the president do last night, when it came to on cap and trade, he said, when it comes to cap and trade, the broader principle is that we've got to move on to a new energy era. And that is saying, I'm giving up. I'll take what I can get on this.
Do you agree with that, Eamon?
Yeah, I think the Byron's right. I mean, the president is signaling he's going to compromise a little bit here. But I have to go back and check my parliamentary procedure. I'm a little bit fuzzy on this. But I think that on budget reconciliation, the president doesn't actually sign that. That's a resolution between the two chambers of Congress. But in any case, you know, the important thing here is that the president is signaling to Congress that he's willing to take a little bit less than he asked for. And I think that's what he's going to get. I mean, Democrats are going to chop some of this stuff out of there.
And that's question, a little bit less, perhaps a little bit less on each of the programs, or a fundamental not going to go for it on cap and trade.
But it's a negotiation. Yes. And of course, when Absolutely. Obama started out, he put his high number out there because he knows it's going to come down from there no matter what he does. So he puts out a big number and then whittles down to something he thinks he can live with anyway.
But it's not his only bite at the apple here, because you can pass cap and trade. You can do energy and education matters, too, outside of the budget reconciliation process. I mean, the House Energy Commerce Committee, Henry Waxman, is going to have a bill out by, you know, of some sort by the end of May. And as he, you know, said last night, he said, you know, he was kind of vague about whether he wouldn't sign a budget bill with this, but he pointed to what the Energy and Commerce Committee is doing as another venue. So, I mean, I think you're right, Eamon. You know, you go for everything you want. Why not?
Yeah,
you know,
right.
initially, but you also realize that there are other ways to get it out of Congress, and it may not all come in one big ball of wax.
But strategically, putting everything, he put everything but the kitchen sink into this budget,
right.
And strategically that's important because in budget reconciliation, you only need 50 votes in the Senate,
51.
50 plus one,
right.
to get something passed,
yeah.
as opposed to outside that process, in the regular order of things in the Senate, you need really 60 votes these days.
How much can we attribute what's happening in the housing market to what President Obama has already done, and how much of it is simply getting past that crisis, Byron?
Personally, I don't think you can attribute it a lot to what he has actually done. The housing initiative, what was it, $275 billion that he announced a few weeks ago, I don't think is really having a huge effect. We are seeing one interesting thing. Sales of new homes are still going down. Sales of existing homes actually jumped in the last month.
And much to the surprise of economists who had predicted
exactly.
the downturn.
Now, a number of people are attributing that to a greater number of homes that have been foreclosed,
right.
Selling on a kind of a fire sale basis. On the other hand, these are each one is a little toxic asset out there that's actually being purchased by someone in the market. So that's a good thing.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not enough of a housing market expert to make the connection there. He tried last night, the president did, to say, listen, we put out this plan and sales of existing homes are going up, interest rates are going down. What did he say, 40% of homes out there are now eligible for refinancing. And I know I have friends who are rushing to refinance, and it's going to make a big difference in their monthly pocketbook.
All right, let's talk about the violence in Mexico that he addressed, Eamon.
Yeah, the president took a question on that and very deliberately sought out the reporter who he knew was going to ask him about that. And they've announced a bunch of new initiatives just yesterday on Mexico. And the problem there is that you've got these drug cartels, which are really threatening the stability of the government in Mexico.
Jose Calderon has gone after, and that's creating the huge problem.
And there are these assassinations. I mean, appalling numbers on assassinations of political figures and police officers in Mexico. And really the concern for the United States is that that violence is spilling over into America. And for Barack Obama, this is just a fundamental national security issue. And so they had Janet Napolitano out yesterday at Homeland Security announcing a whole raft of new measures.
Including?
Partly what they're doing is going after the export of guns from the United States to Mexico, and making the point that part of what's fueling this is the easy supply of weapons coming from us to them, as opposed to violence coming from them to us.
What about China and the faith in the dollar, Byron?
Well, this is something the president has to talk up, because what happened is China, in essence, issued a margin call last week saying that, look, we have bought all of this debt, and we depend enormously on the stability of the American economy, and perhaps we shouldn't be doing that anymore unless we have signs from the American government that they're truly serious about fixing this problem. So, I mean, this is something a few weeks ago the president made a shift from talking down the economy to talking up the economy, and that's what he's doing now.
He said, as far as confidence in the U.S. economy or the dollar, I would just point out the dollar is extraordinarily strong right now. The reason the dollar is strong is because investors consider the United States the strongest economy in the world with the most stable political system in the world. He is assuring the whole world.
Well, he is, and you know, talk though obviously is cheap, but it does seem at the moment, and this may be more of a comment on the rest of the world than on us, the United States still is one of the better investment opportunities out there, and the Chinese have to park their billions somewhere, and they can, you know, they showed a little nervousness yesterday, but and until they actually find a better place to put their money, I think Barack Obama doesn't have to worry that much about it, although it could end up being a major problem for him to face.
Ayman Jeffers, the president did not call on any reporters from major newspapers.
Yeah, and that's being perceived in Washington as a fairly serious diss to the old media. And he called on several new media outlets. I mean, he called on Stars and Stripes, which I can't remember a press conference at which Stars and Stripes.
He called on Politico,
not to give us another plug, but there you go.
He called on Ann Compton, and she was totally taken aback.
There was an urban legend in the press room last night, people were talking that the people who were going to be called on
knew it,
got heads up emails earlier, and it just so happened that I was sitting right behind Mike Allen of Politico, Politico.com, and right behind the woman from Univision who asked the Mexican question, and everyone was kind of like happy and almost giddy that he wasn't calling on the New York Times, Washington Post, Wall Street Journal, USA Today, Bloomberg, Reuters. At this first press conference a couple weeks ago, he did basically everybody who you would predict, and then he threw in Sam Stein of Huffington Post. This time around, people were saying, we're just props here, but he really shook things up, and I think that's all for the better. I was very encouraged by the choice of questioners last night.
At 27 before the hour, you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. Byron.
I do think he's actually sent some messages in this, and David's right about calling on a lot of the usual suspects in the first press conference, but he did call on the Huffington Post. Then he does not call from, let's just say it, the Washington Post, the New York Times, Wall Street Journal, or USA Today. No questions for any of them last night. And by the way, he skipped the gridiron dinner over the weekend, which is a Washington institution, especially with the very, very establishment press. Originally, there had been a story that he was going to spend spring break with the family in Chicago. Then it turns out he just went to Camp David for the night. It was
just didn't want to go.
Some writer called it "It's the night I'm washing my hair" excuse he gave to the gridiron. But it is a message he's sending to some of the old gatekeepers of the press that he doesn't view them as important. As they view themselves.
Well, I don't see it necessarily as a negative message. The White House operation, press operation, is very sensitive to all those media outlets and to places like Politico. But I think the message was, hey, we have a wider view of the media horizon. And while the first one, we went by the numbers, this time we're going to mix it up. And who knows what we're going to do next time. So, I mean, I don't think it was
a
dissing.
We may call on some of us talk show hosts.
Well, I hope so.
If we're allowed to come.
I'm sure you could get in, Diane,
absolutely.
If you wanted to.
Absolutely.
I think he will. I mean, I think he's got a very, as David says, he's got a very broad sense of what the media is these days. And that reflects huge changes in the structure of the media. And the mainstream guys don't have the influence that they used to have.
All right, let's open the phones, hear what our listeners have to say. First to Sandra in San Antonio, Texas. Good morning to you.
Good morning, Diane.
Hi there. Go right ahead.
Thank you for having me on your show.
Sure.
I listen to you every morning.
Thank you.
Well, President Obama has been in office for, about 65 days? And I believe he's working doubly hard as any president in my lifetime or in my memory. You know, he's got a horrible mess in America that he has to deal with and abroad. I believe that his policies do represent fundamental change in America, but I think the media is hammering him and not letting go of issues like the AIG bonuses and, you know, his knowledge of when they were to be paid out. You know, he's also getting hammered by the press and quarrelsome Republicans. I have two questions. Does the media's, you know, relentless scrutiny and the Republican criticism have anything to do with President Obama's skin color? And then my second question is, does his optimism that he reflects get on the nerves of the mainstream media because it's not sexy enough?
Interesting. Skin color, David Corn.
I think the answer is no. I think Republicans would be bashing any Democratic president, whether they were black, white, blue, or purple at this point in time. It's in their nature. It's actually part of the job description. And I think the reporters, too, would be grilling. I would be encouraging them, if they weren't, to grill any president about these very big policy matters that are coming down the pike.
And what about optimism?
Well, I don't think it's the optimism that's the problem. First of all, on the issue of race, the president was actually specifically asked a question about this, given the opportunity to say whether race had played any role in any of his dealings in the White House, and he said no. But in terms of his optimism, look, Republicans do oppose this, and there is a reason for this. I mean, the big issue right now is spending with these enormous deficits that Obama is proposing. Last night he was asked about it, and he said, look, Republicans don't have a lot of room to talk given what they did in the last few years. But it is a fact that Democrats and candidate Obama criticized Republican spending during the campaign, and now they're going to triple the deficits that they criticized Republicans for running up. So there's a real issue involved here.
And he did several times remind viewers and the press that he inherited a huge deficit when he walked into the White House. We'll take a short break. More of your questions when we come back. Stay with us.
National broadcast of the Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by the German Embassy, presenting Germany Info, a web publication with daily news from Germany, business and investment information, and suggestions for travel to Europe on the web at germany.info. By Harvard's Program on Negotiation, details on June negotiation workshops for all professionals are available at pon.harvard.edu. And by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, helping NPR advance journalistic excellence in the digital age. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Demand for water is increasing rapidly, but traditional approaches like dams, wells, and river diversion are only part of the solution. The current state of the nation's water infrastructure and what it will take to avert critical shortages in the years ahead. The Diane Rehm Show, next hour. Welcome back, and we'll go right back to the phones, 800-433-8850 to Syracuse, New York. Good morning, Ray. You're on the air.
Good morning, Diane.
Hi there.
Yes, I'd like to ask a question. When President Bush came into office, there was a surplus of the budget, and immediately Bush says he's going to reduce the taxes. Well, as time went on, he started borrowing money, and yet he wouldn't raise taxes. He's been advised by his administration as the years went on that he had to raise taxes in order to cover the budget. But he refused, and there's some in his administration that have quit because they saw the outcome of his policy. My question is, is it possible that President Bush, knowing that after his 8 years, that a Democrat, Hillary Clinton, was going to run, that he was going to sack this budget on the Democratic administration?
Byron.
Well, if I go back to my Bush administration history, at the time, the surplus, the administration always argued that the surplus disappeared for three reasons. The bust of the tech boom, the war on terror, and the president's tax cuts, which he, you know, were extended
but
to 2010.
Wait a minute, Byron. The
all right.
War in Iraq was off the budget.
We all know what the war in Iraq cost. And the idea that...
But it wasn't even counted.
The idea that it's off the budget was... We know what the deficits are. And the issue is, I think the caller is suggesting that Bush perhaps decided to sandbag his successor that way. The deficits were actually going down. If you look at them in 04, 05, 06, and 07, the deficits were getting smaller and got to in the 200-something billion-dollar range, which now seems tiny. If you put aside 2009, which is this year, which Obama has inherited, there's TARP, there's a stimulus, there's all this stuff, just put that aside. Don't blame anybody for that. Still, when you look at Obama's deficit projections, they're rather astonishing.
I think it would be a good idea to put the blame aside and simply move on. David?
Well, I don't want to do that.
You don't want to do that?
No,
okay.
But I mean Bush did put two wars on the credit cards, and we talked earlier in the show about sacrifice, and he said we could fight wars without anybody having to actually sacrifice in terms of paying higher taxes. It was on the first time in times in American history where we had a war and tax rates did not go up to pay for that war. And I don't think he purposely did this, though, to sandbag the Democrats who might inherit the mess. But we do know back, it's without doubt, in the Reagan years, that the Republican strategy was to run up deficits purposefully, David Stockman confessed to this, in order to put pressure on Congress to get rid of social programs that the conservatives did not like.
All right, and here's an email on sacrifice from Nancy in St. Louis. She says, my husband and I are perennial taxpayers, and our investments have lost 30% of their value in the past few months because of the Wall Street subprime deregulation mess. Those two factors alone are quite enough sacrifice from the two of us looking toward retirement and putting the last of three sons through college.
Well, she agrees with the president. I mean, that's exactly what Barack Obama said last night, that Americans are sacrificing in this financial wipeout. And I think we're going to hear Timothy Geithner, the Secretary of the Treasury, hit this point again today as he speaks in New York, and he's going to talk about how unfair it is that the burden of this economic wipeout falls largely on innocent Americans who were following the rules and behaving responsibly, and it's the actions of a few irresponsible folks who took on enormous risk that most Americans couldn't understand, and they clearly didn't understand, that caused the kind of pain that the emailer's talking about.
Let's go to Grand Rapids, Michigan. Frank, you're on the air. Go right ahead, sir.
Okay, thank you for taking the call.
Sure.
My comment is I have sort of a different take than some of your panel had on President Obama's response to Ed Henry. It was sort of I think a lot of times what you see when people get caught off guard is their true character coming through, and it was actually a mean and nasty and very disingenuous response. I mean, for two reasons. One, if it took him 2 days to figure out what was going on, where the heck was he back in the fall when he supported the bill, and where the heck was he when his Treasury Department was pushing for this? And two, you know, if he can push through a stimulus bill and another bailout bill in 24 hours, what takes him 2 days to figure this out? I think what we're seeing in these exchanges is, you know, the fact that, yeah, he's maybe a smart guy and everything, but it's, you know, there's some of this idol worship that I think we've had with him, and, you know, some of this perception of him does come across as a very arrogant and very testy person when he's challenged.
David Korn.
Well, that certainly is in the eye of the beholder. Most Americans, when they voted last November, did not have that impression of Barack Obama. And my guess is, if you took a poll, they would not. That would not be a majority position. I mean, as Byron noted just a few minutes ago, conventional wisdom in Washington might be in the process of shifting on this whole outrage over the AIG bonuses. In fact, there's a very interesting letter in the New York Times today from the guy who was the vice president of AIG Financial Products, who is quitting, and he's going to give his bonus to charity. And he makes a very strong case. You know, this is something that should be reported out, for saying that he himself and others who worked there were not responsible for the credit default swaps that brought AIG down.
And he was actually part of the financial products division.
And he was part of the division that which this happened. And, you know, I'm not sure this is a game changer, but I think Barack Obama, by saying it took a few days, actually, you know, it's very easy to react to headlines. And we all do that. I do that, too. I'm sometimes asked to do that on various shows. But, you know, to say it takes a few days to sort something out, particularly when you have conflicting reports, is not, to me, beyond the pale or a sign of arrogance.
Well, the president's demeanor aside, I mean, it was indeed a put down, but there was a serious issue or a serious question here about that, because it is true that when the AIG bonuses burst into the public controversy, it was unclear what the administration knew about them, and it is a fact that they were the provision that protected these bonuses was in the stimulus bill. The president and Democrats in Congress pushed it through. Republicans and others complained that there had not been enough time for public inspection of the bill, and now we find out that bonus thing was in there. So it's an actual issue.
Amen.
Well, it was clearly a testy response. I mean, you could see there was sort of a flintiness in Barack Obama's eyes as he smacked down that question from Ed Henry. And Ed Henry himself on CNN later made some hay out of this moment, you know, as reporters who are at the center of one of these little brouhahas tend to do. And Ed said his take was that, in fact, Barack Obama just didn't want to talk about the AIG mess anymore and was sort of resentful that he had gotten pushed as hard as Ed was pushing him on this issue, when the whole purpose of this press conference was really to push AIG off the front pages and refocus Americans' attention on the fact that, you know, as Obama said, progress is being made.
And I'll bet you that as many people who were watching out there, as many people who felt as you did that it was a put down, there were people out there who were cheering with Obama's response.
There are probably a lot of people who thought that Ed needed a put down there for that question, but clearly it was a put down. He was smacking down that question.
And here is an email from Mark, who says, "Every time I hear the president speak, his calm and reassuring demeanor actually makes me feel confident, just as I'm about to spend a few bucks on something to do my small part in stimulating the economy."
Did this letter come from the White House?
I hear a radio story from Republicans saying the president's plan is not going to work. It's like a dagger in my gut. I just wish the Republicans would quit being so negative and start supporting the president.
You know, this was kind of the lesson of the Reagan years. You know, optimism, sunniness, even if it's in, you know, support of a policy that may be wrong or you oppose, is often very hard to go up against. You know, it's something called leadership. Barack Obama has demonstrated he has pretty solid leadership skills. He showed that on the campaign by defeating more experienced politicians, of both in his own party and with John McCain. And, so much of the economy, unfortunately, is based on psychological reactions. And the White House obviously wants to be able to give people confidence. It buys him more time. And maybe if they spend some money, it will create some more jobs. And so they get letters like that. You know, one doesn't probably do much. But if they have millions of letters like that pouring into the White House this morning, they would be very, very delighted.
All right, let's go to Oklahoma City. Deborah, I know you've been waiting. Go right ahead.
As I was waiting, I was hearing so many people saying the same thing. But thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
Diane, you and your show are a gift to our nation.
Oh, thank you.
The first caller and several others expressed much of my own frustration with the nitpicking of the press. And I don't blame President Obama for choosing alternative reporters. He promised change. and maybe the press will start to listen. But I wanted to note that directly following the press conference, our public television station went on to Frontline, which reviewed the Bush administration economic choices. By the way, they talked about the reconciliation that Bush used for his tax cuts. I wish that all the stations had carried that program, because our country needs perspective, and we don't get that in the press. We get headlines. We get the nitpicking I was talking about. We don't get perspective and thoughtfulness.
You know, it was interesting. I turned to each and every channel that had carried the press conference. No analysis, no nothing. The press conference, which usually comes.
Well, they had to go right to their entertainment programming and make the money because, yeah. You know, he took up the hour, which I'm glad he did. You know, that's where people can turn to cable to hear analysis, chattering. You know, I thought the end of the press conference was really, really interesting. We haven't really gotten to that. But he used this phrase, which sounds kind of corny, but what he called it, he basically said that he believes in the whole philosophy of persistence. And the question he did this. The question was about Middle East. How, you know, and he said it's hard, but we made progress in North Island. And while we're talking about it, let me tell you how hard it's going to be here. And this is not a speedboat; it's an ocean liner. And we have to teach persistence to our children in our own lives, and basically with me. And it was like, you know, it was almost like a preacher talking, you know, reverend. And I thought it was an interesting moment that people could chew over for some time.
At 7 minutes before the hour, you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. Byron.
Well, he's got to do this, and one of the reasons he's doing it is try to convince people in his own party on Capitol Hill. The caller mentioned the reconciliation issue, and I believe the chairman of the Senate Budget Committee, Kent Conrad, says we're not going to do that on health care. We're just not going to do it. It hasn't been done on a major policy initiative like that before, and passing an overhaul of the American health care system on 51 votes is something that he, who is a Democrat and the chairman of the Budget Committee, a fairly important guy, doesn't want to do. So Obama is actually preaching to his own side as well as the general public.
And the president is going to Capitol Hill today, is he not, to talk with Democrats, talk with Republicans, to try to convince them that if this isn't done, we pass it to the next generation.
Yeah, and he's got to rein in some of these slightly recalcitrant Democrats up on Capitol Hill who are starting to go a little bit wobbly on him on the budget. Obama's got to go up and do a sales pitch to his own people. But if I could, just a note on the stagecraft of last night. I mean, you talk about there being no analysis after this program. The president had asked for an hour from the networks, and he talked for 57 minutes exactly. And he and the White House know what that means. When you go to 57, there's only 3 minutes left in the hour. He knows he's not leaving the networks enough time to provide analysis. If he'd wanted them to do analysis, he would have ended at 50 and given 7 minutes for analysis. He didn't do that because he wanted to take the hour. He didn't want talking heads to have that time. That was his time.
And also, you know, this is still the first year of a 4-year term, if not 8 years of an Obama
president. First 64 days.
And so he can, you know, as we talked.
65. How come he hasn't fixed everything yet?
And so, you know, so
how come it's not all fixed yet?
Yeah,
so he shot the moon with his budget request, but if health care and other matters get taken out of it and don't go through on reconciliation, he can try doing it through the more conventional methods. But if there is a filibuster on any of these fronts, he's free to come back next year and say, okay, I gave the Republicans a chance to play. They didn't play with me. Now I'm going to try to use reconciliation. And at that point, Democrats going into an election year might be antsy to get something done and might go along. So, you know, I would be very surprised if he gets all this through by summer vacation.
So would I.
Look, he's playing.
Come on, disagree with that one.
He's playing three-dimensional chess here. I mean, he knows that there are a lot of different options.
Quick question from Tina in Miami, Florida. Go right ahead, please.
Good morning, Diane, and thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I wanted to make a few comments about the press conference last night.
Very briefly.
Okay. I thought he did an amazing job last night. I thought his comments were thoughtful and measured, and that's exactly what I like about him. I think, unfortunately, he does have to think about everything that he says before he comes out with it, because God forbid he says the wrong thing, and then you're going to have the media jumping all over him about it for 3 days, like the whole Special Olympics mishap. And, I think that we need to give him the time that he needs, and that, if people don't want to hear him blaming the Bush administration all the time, then let him take the time that he needs to fix everything that was broken before he came into office.
All right, Tina, thanks for your
comments. There's that philosophy of persistence. Persistence takes time. You can also call it the philosophy of patience.
Byron.
But it's a good thing that he's being asked these questions, and it's a good thing that opposition Republicans on Capitol Hill are raising questions about this deficit. He is proposing a huge change, more than our system is usually able to process at one time. So it's a good thing the opposition is there to raise the questions.
Amen. Last word.
I just want to defend the media here real quick. I mean, it's our job to scrutinize presidents of the United States and ask them very tough questions. And if anything, I think you can argue that we didn't do that enough with President Bush, particularly in the run-up to the Iraq War. So it's our job to ask tough questions when big issues of national importance are being decided.
Eamon Javers, he's correspondent for Politico. Byron York, the Washington Examiner. David Korn, a Washington bureau chief for Mother Jones Magazine, a blogger for CQPolitics.com. Thank you all.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And thanks for listening, everybody. I'm Diane Rehm.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkard, Nancy Robertson, Jonathan Smith, Tanya Weinberg, and Susan Neighbors. The engineer is Toby Schreiner. Dori Annisman answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives and CD sales, transcripts from SoftScribe, and podcasts. Call 202-885-1200 for more information. Our email address is drshow@wamu.org. This program comes to you from American University in Washington. This is NPR, National Public Radio.